Hello, everybody. This is Jake Sanzino, host of the Jake and Gino podcast, with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, chef, father, six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbagino. How's it going?
Jake, I'm doing great, brother. How you doing?
Always making it happen, big man. Today's guest is host of Annie's Triple Digit Flip and internationally renowned real estate investor, entrepreneur, and podcast host. The common thread in all of his activities is a profound commitment to teaching others how to invest and profit in real estate in a smart, strategic, and ethical way. So without further ado, Jamil Damji, welcome to the show.
Thank you, gentlemen. How are you today?
Hey, we are always making it happen. It's our pleasure to have you here. And let's get this kicked off. Let's hear a little bit about your background and how you got started in business.
Awesome. So my background actually had nothing to do with real estate. And when I first got in, I went to university and got a degree in physiology. I'm of East Indian descent, and so I was born to be a doctor. And my parents really groomed me to follow that career path. And I actually walked those steps for many years, having gone to university, got a degree in physiology. I took the medical school entrance exam, got all the way to an interview to go to medical school, and then I didn't make it. And so I had a real interesting crossroads in my life at that point, because I saw that someone else had the ability to decide for me my destiny. And I think that's when everything dawned on me that I had to go a different path. And so I left school and decided not to try to pursue a second attempt at entering medical school. And I entered the world of entrepreneurship. While I got into entrepreneurship, I didn't, again, start my way into real estate. I got into a media company in the early 2000s, where this struggling company was trying to convince businesses that this thing called the internet was going to be a problem and something that they should be investing in for their futures. And so I was literally calling out of the phone book in the yellow pages businesses and saying, hey, instead of just advertising in the phone book, yellow pages, you should be having an online presence, and I can build you a 6-page website for $600. And I did really well in that role. But unfortunately, because I really didn't know the intricacies of that business, we came to find out that every $600 website that I sold actually cost us $700 to make. So I effectively put us out of business. However, it took us about a year and a half, actually. Cash flow is a interesting thing. You know, when it comes in, it goes out, it comes in and goes out. And then at the end of the day, you realize you're in trouble.
We say if it doesn't cash flow, we let the grass grow. So that's not only in real estate, that's in every single business, people. So that's an important concept, I think.
It sure is. But I did find myself in an interesting situation there, where my business partner and his father were also involved in real estate. And they would take these old bungalows, knock them down, and build luxury duplexes. And every time they do one of these projects, they'd make over $150,000. And so they were talking about a project they had just finished. And I interrupted and asked—
Where was this, Jamil?
Pardon me?
What part of the country was this in?
This is in Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Oh, okay. So we're not even in the U.S.
The U.S., no. And I asked how I can get involved, you know, and their answer was, you can't. You don't have any credit. You don't have any money. You have no real estate license. There's nothing you can do to help us. And they carry on complaining that they don't have any houses. And so I asked, okay, well, what do you mean you don't have any houses? Maybe I can help there. And their reply was, well, if you can find us some of these bungalows with the correct zoning on it that we can do a project on, we'd gladly buy it. So the next day I'm walking my dog, and I passed by a house that's for rent that I'd actually tried to rent 3 months earlier, but it was $200 out of my monthly budget to be able to live there. So I knew that there was a little bit of pain here for this homeowner, because she had been unsuccessful in renting the house. So I just called and I asked if she'd be interested in selling instead of renting, because she'd been unsuccessful to this time. And her reply was, sure, if I got the right price for it. And I asked what that number was. She said $350,000. So I scurry on over to the office and I ask my business partner how much him and his father would pay for that house. And the response was
$400,000. Yeah.
So now I got a $50,000 problem to solve, right? Because I don't have any money. I can't buy the house, but I know I can do a deal here. I just got to figure out how. So first thing I do is I call family and friends and I ask if anyone can loan me money. Of course, nobody wants to loan me money, right? No one's going to say, yeah, we know what you're, we think you know what you're doing, and gladly write you a check.
Wait a second. He's saying he's going to pay $4,000. She wants $350,000. It's a done deal. I don't see the problem here. Just get it done.
Yeah, well, you think so, but I had no idea how to do it.
Okay, I was going to say, you take the $4,000, you take the $50,000 for yourself, and you say, thanks, everybody. It's been real. Love you all.
Yes. It's exactly what I wanted to do, but how, right? Okay. I had no education. I didn't know how to do a double escrow or any of that, right? For me at that time, I was so green that everything
just seemed
impossible.
I just can't put my finger on it. I got you. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I do what I know how to do, which is start cold calling. So I start cold calling real estate attorneys, and I get all the way to the letter S, because this attorney by the name of David Steed answered his phone because he was so fresh out of law school. He didn't have a secretary yet. And him and I get into a conversation. I tell him the situation, and he said, oh, that's easy to do. It's called a skip transfer. That's what they call a double escrow in Canada, skip transfer. And he explained how to do it. He said, I'm going to email you a contract. You're going to print out two copies of this contract. One of the contracts, you're going to be the buyer of that property, but make sure on your buyer name you write and or assignee.
Assigns, yeah.
On the second contract, you're going to be the seller of the property at the higher price. Then you're going to bring both of those contracts to my office. I'm going to do the conveyancing, and in a few weeks, come and pick up a check. And it happened. $47,000 after his fees is what I received. And for a guy that grew up with very little, that was life-changing for me.
Ding, ding,
and
ding,
I realized at that point that I was onto something. I did. The funny thing about it, Jake, is that money, I actually had that bank draft, the cashier's check, in my wallet for months. I was scared to cash it until somebody said, this is going to expire if you don't deposit this in the bank. You've got to put it in the bank. I just didn't. I was so poor.
Dude, I'd be running to the bank immediately to cash that shit. Like, let's get that money cleared, baby. Come on. Hey, so
again,
did your partner at the time get pissed when he found out that you profited in that scenario, or was he cool about it?
No. He was cool about it. He's good. Yeah. He was absolutely cool about it. Because they, in fact, I came to find out afterwards they would have paid $450,000 for it. I just didn't negotiate well.
And I took like 50 G's on the table. You know. Shit.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Jamil, I want to backtrack though. What did your parents think about when you told them, Mom, Dad, I ain't going to med school. I'm going to start flipping homes, or I'm going to start building websites. What was that conversation? What did that sound like?
Devastating to them. To say that they were heartbroken would be an understatement, because I was essentially thumbing my nose at them and saying, all of the hard work that they had done, all of the sacrifices that they had made to be able to help me, accomplish going to university, all of it. You know, my father shoveled gravel his whole life. My mom was a data entry operator, and she worked for 12 hours a day just typing on a keyboard, entering in people's information so that they could, she worked for a company that processed checks. So if you get a check in Canada, her company was the one that created the check for you. So, you know, they both worked so hard, and they tried to give my sister and I the best life. And here I was walking away from it. And I was a 4.0 student. I was really intelligent, but I in their eyes gave up. I gave up because I felt so embarrassed that I didn't make it to medical school. And this is the thing that was really, really angered me at the time. So, you know, I had family members that were trying to get into medical school at the exact same time as I did. And one of my cousins, who's now a physician, he actually had gone out the night before the medical school entrance exam and stayed out a little too late. And he was a little rusty the day of the exam. I can say this now because nobody can go back and get us in trouble. But we were on the organic chemistry section of the test, and he blanks. He completely blanks and looks back at me and asks me to help him out. So I let him cheat off me. I let him cheat on the organic chemistry section of the exam. He gets into medical school and I don't.
Well, I think it worked out.
It did.
Let me ask you, how did it make you feel? Because that must have been a big limiting belief that there's a little self-sabotage going on there, saying, I didn't really fulfill my parents' dreams. Am I doing the right thing? Am I holding myself back? Am I getting into the business, or should I be getting into? What were your thought processes? Do you think that held you back going forward?
I don't know that it held me back. I think that at that point, I got so, I personally, I felt empowered, because I was no longer beholden to any concept of, you know, what I want, what my parents wanted for me, or what society wanted for me, or my culture, or, you know, the people from my ethnic community expected of me. None of that mattered anymore. I was the black sheep, and I was wearing the black sheep coat proudly. I'm like, F everybody. I'm done living up to your expectations. I'm going to go and do it myself. So yeah, it was tough, man. Like I for a few years, I know every time I would walk into my parents' house, they were sad. You know, they were disappointed.
Mm-hmm. I've been there. Jake and I, when we started investing together, I remember the first deal we did back in 2013. I didn't tell my mom because she says, I've got six mouths to feed. You're taking a lot of risk. We had a small restaurant business together. I'd been in business with the family for years. And I remember in 2015, I sit down with my mom outside in the parking lot. And I'm like, Mom, I've got 200 units with Jake. It's about time I leave the restaurant. And the look on her face was complete and utter confusion. First of all, how could you leave the business? Second of all, how the hell did you do it? And it was very, I mean, same thing. I mean, immigrants worked hard. We created a small business. And I think for all the parents out there, I think, you know, this is a lesson for parents. You want to help your kids out, but your kids have to make their own decisions. And you don't want to live your life through your children. And you want to safe. You want to give them a great life. But at the end of the day, it's their choice to make. Don't force them to go do anything. Because then at a certain point, they may become a doctor or a lawyer. They may regret that when they get to be middle age, 45, 50 years old, they're going to look back and go, I didn't want this life. My parents forced me to have this life. So, you know, Jamila, you're another Jake and Gino guest who is unemployable. I could see that from the very beginning. Most of the guests we have on, they try W-2 for about 3 minutes and then they peace out. That's the reality. So I love that about you. You do that first deal. What's the next step? You got $47,000 burning a hole in your pocket. You're like, there's proof of concept here. What's the next step for Jamil?
So I bought a car.
I went.
Well, I got something that wasn't too crazy. I went and bought a GMC Jimmy. That's like that little two-door Blazer Jimmy style. It was $15,000. Great purchase. I wish I still had it. I upgraded that in my life, right? I got a little bit of a better vehicle and I started driving around. That's it. Like I just went up and down the streets of all of these neighborhoods looking for houses for rent. And then I would, back then, the place where people would advertise rentals were the newspaper. So then I would buy the newspaper every day and go into the classifieds and I'd look at all the classifieds and I'd call all the people that had houses for rent. I would go and look at all of these apartment buildings that were being converted into condominiums. And I would call the handwritten signs that were for rent there. And I'd talk to the building manager and get in touch with the building owner. And then I would flip those. So I went from single family making that $47,000. Pardon me? So
real quick, I want to understand the why there, though, because it's interesting that you say I was going around looking at the for rent buildings. Was that because you were finding small mom and pop landlords that were probably pissed because the tenant called them the night before with the leaky toilet, eventually getting burned out? And the stuff that the team that you already had was seen on market for sale, they already had access to that. So you had to find a niche that was outside of their purview where you could actually drum up some leads that they didn't see. Is that fair to say?
Correct.
Okay. Just wanted to get a little background.
Nobody wanted to buy anything that was already listed, right? They wanted off market, like real exclusive things. And I got that. I understood what they were looking for. And I knew that it was just going to take sweat equity for me. I just had to hit the pavement. And that's what I did. Every single day, I would drive around in my GMC Jimmy, listening to Tupac, calling these landlords and just asking if they had a desire to sell. And, you know, I would be successful 5% of the time. But that 5% of the time that I'd be successful, I made bank. Like on flipping an apartment building, I could make $100,000 minimum. And for the next few years, that's all I did. I stacked money. I did really well until I made my most terrible decision, which was instead of wholesaling, I was going to become a developer. I saw the guy who was converting one of these apartment buildings into a condominium, and he pulls up in this Rolls Royce, and you know, every part of my being was like just enamored by all of it. The wealth,
this is the next level. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what it looks like. Right. So I say to my parents, now they've seen I've made money. Everybody is now cheering me on. And my sister and I, who were partners then and are still today, we decide that, okay, instead of wholesaling the next few buildings that you find, let's actually buy them. And that's what we do. So I get 4 apartment buildings and we close on them. And I have my mom and dad co-sign on construction and purchase loans for me. And this is in 2007.
Oh, fuck.
Wow.
Then what happens?
And, you know, very, very quickly... Very quickly, everything unravels. We lose the buildings. I lose all of the money that we had put down in down payments. My mother and father's home, our childhood home, gets foreclosed on. And there's a moment where it's myself, my sister, my dad, my mom, our 150-pound dog, our cat, my niece, living in a 2-bedroom, 1-bath apartment, and I destroyed everything.
That's strike 2.
Yep.
Oh, that's brutal.
Wow, what... Once that happens, when did you realize that wholesaling was a business? Did you go back to wholesaling after that and say, I need to pick myself up? But more importantly, Jameel, let me ask you, how did you have the mental fortitude to say 5%? Because most people listening right now are like, if you really grasp that, you're talking to 100 people, maybe 10 are iffy, 5 are like, let's go. You've got 90 to 95 people slamming the phone at you, calling you an MF-er, doing whatever. How did you work through that? Is that something that you learn? Is it a skill that's innate? Can other people learn how to do it? What were you doing to get through those conversations to get to the people that were saying yes?
Well, I had learned that it was always a numbers game because I had sold websites, right? I was calling people out of the yellow pages and pitching all day long. So talking to people on the telephone was not hard for me. And being told to F off was not a problem for me. And knowing that this is all a follow-up process, this is all a numbers game, I just have to talk to and get in front of enough people and somebody is going to buy. So to me, that had already been proven in the business that I was in that hadn't been successful selling websites. So this process was easy. Now I just was selling and flipping a different product.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I think everybody out there, I think Jameel understood that people aren't saying no to Jameel. They're saying no to his offer. Don't take it personally. I think that a lot of us do. It has a lot to do with ego and it has a lot to do with pridefulness. Show the humility. Just say, hey, I have an opportunity for you. Would you like to buy it? And they're not saying no to you. They're just saying to know the offer you make. And I think if you can take that one thing from the show, if you could take that one little nugget from the show, this will vastly improve your ability to close and ability to find offers there. So Jameel, it's 2008. You're living with your 150-pound dog in a 2-bedroom apartment. What do you do next? Like, you know, I couldn't imagine living with my mom and dad in the same apartment that I just lost some hundreds of thousands of dollars on. And what's the next step? What do we do next?
Well, I, at that point, decided that this real estate thing is too stressful and hard for me. And I actually moved to Los Angeles to become a stand-up comedian.
Really? Wow. That's strike 3, bro. I mean, like,
dude, you're out. You're never going back home after that, dude. What are you doing?
What was really interesting, though, is now my parents believed in me. Even though I messed up and even though, like, you know, we were in that spot, they saw me make millions of dollars. And they said, you know, our son is the one. He actually will get it done, and we believe in him. No matter how hard life is right now, we're all together. We're unified. We love each other.
That's cool.
And you know, the funny thing was is that we were all living together, and even though we were poor again, and it was hard. It was so hard. But I got to eat my mom's cooking every day. I got to sit and watch golf with my dad. I got to watch my niece go to elementary school and take her to school every day and be a part of that. And so there was beauty in that time, even though it didn't look good. And even though we were dusty and things were hard, my family, my sister, my parents, we were intact. Our love was intact. The bond and the unity in our family remained.
Mm-hmm. When you're doing the comedy, how does it lend you get back into real estate? I mean, I'm sure that comedy is not paying the
bills.
Well,
I want to hear about the comedy a little bit too, and maybe like pull a joke or something here too. Like Gina will sing for you, but you know, I want
to
hear a joke.
I don't have any in my back pocket, but I'll try to crack some as we go. You know, I don't want to make fun of you guys
spot,
either.
So. Oh, it's so
dude,
easy, bro. It's the easiest thing in the world.
We're here to be made fun of. Like, we'll take that as a badge of honor from a former comedian, all right? Like, come on.
Oh man. But you know, I it wasn't paying the bills, of course, right? Like you're not a, you're in comedy, you don't make money until you're Kevin Hart. Like that's how it is, right? You're doing, even if you're at the, and I was featuring at the Comedy Store, right? I was at the big clubs. I performed at the Laugh Factory. I performed at
so
the Hollywood Improv.
So you can do stand up. Like you can do it. Like you can be a proficient comedian. You're not like at the top tier, but you're at least a B.
Maybe a C+.
C plus,
cool, B-. Yeah. I don't know. Nothing special. I wasn't terrible. Nobody booed me off the stage too many times, but it happened. You know, I mean, I had good sets and bad sets, but I did it. At least I had the courage to stand up and try. Right.
That's off. Yeah.
But I realize that it's not going to pay the bills, even though I wanted to, and even though I want to make it in entertainment, it's not happening. And now I'm in this situation where I proposed to the love of my life, my wife, who I've been married to now for 9 years, Natalie. And, you know, she was going to be moving from Canada because her and I met when I lived in Calgary, and now I'm living in Los Angeles. And so she's going to immigrate to the United States, and that's going to be a financial process and burden, right? I have to come up with money to do that. And then I'm realizing now that I don't really have anything going on, right? I have to try to do something, but what? And so what brings me back to real estate, it's interesting. I want to rewind first and give a shout out to my sister, because during this time now, right, I'm working or trying to work as a comic. My sister, however, she and my mother and father, they go back to Canada around 2010. And we actually, oddly enough, didn't lose everything. There was two buildings that we had bought for my dad as a joke in the roughest neighborhood in Canada. It's called the North Central neighborhood of Regina, Saskatchewan. The worst neighborhood. We kind of like were laughing about them because we had bought them for my father for his birthday as like a, hey dad, look what we got you. And they were in an LLC that had been separate from all of our other entities. And so when the foreclosures and all of the repossessions happened, they didn't, and they were in another province, so they didn't get attacked. In fact, they just stayed there. They were boarded up and they stayed there. So my sister, she decides we're going to go back and I'm going to bust my butt to try to make something of those two buildings. And she does. So she goes and renovates those units suite by suite by suite. And literally, like, she got one done, and then and got some money, did another one, got a little bit of money, did another one, and just bare bones renovations. She actually rented these units out to the government because there was such a big addiction problem in that area that if she could provide sober living for some of the residents, some of the community, they would overpay for rent. They were paying 25% more than you would get normally for rent. And they were guaranteed rents from the government. So she ends up creating these two sober living houses. We ultimately sell those two buildings, and now we have a little bit of cash. So she saves our butt at that time. I'm living in Los Angeles, basically sucking money away from the family now because they're supporting me out there. So how we get back into real estate in the United States is, as I'm living in LA, I see how expensive it is. I look over at Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm seeing the carnage from the Great Recession, right? The crash had devastated Phoenix so dramatically that condominium units that were selling at one point for $400,000 were being short sold for $25,000.
Wow.
And you could rent those for $800 a month. So it was simple math for us, right? We thought, okay, let's buy as many of these as we can and arbitrage our lifestyle from the rents we're getting in Phoenix. Right. And so that's what we do. We start writing offers on short sales. Now, the short sale game was an interesting time because if you guys were at all involved in buying during that period, you would essentially write 10 offers or even 20 offers, and one would get accepted from the bank. Right. Because everything had to go through an approval process.
Dude, it was like throwing months. It was nuts. Yeah.
Yeah. It took forever, too.
Yeah.
Right. So as we're doing this, we're buying selectively, buying some units that would have good cash flow. And what happened is two short sales come approved that we don't have the money for when they became approved, right? We had already just bought a couple of units. And so we didn't have quite have the money available for these two. And so I do what I knew how to do in the past, which was flip the contract. So I go into Craigslist and I write an ad and I say, hey, I got these two houses in Glendale, Arizona. And this is before they had deed restrictions on these. And so I was able to actually sell wholesale the short sale. But I write these ads in Craigslist and I'm like, hey, I got these two short approved short sales available. No deed restrictions, nothing of it. There's nothing stopping me from selling these contracts. If anyone's interested, give me a call. And this gentleman named Tim Nguyen, who's still very active here in Phoenix, calls me on my ad, like literally 15 minutes after posting it. He goes and drives by the property and I had marked each of them up 10,000 and he negotiated each down $1,000 and there I go. 15 minutes later, I have $18,000. Now I obviously didn't have the money right away, but a few weeks later, the deal's closed. And so I'm thinking to myself, what the heck am I doing here in Los Angeles, spinning my wheels, trying to be a comic, when obviously the God in the universe is pointing to me to get back into real estate and do this, because you know, I'm about to get married. She has a daughter. I have a daughter from a previous relationship. I have responsibilities. I'm sucking resources away from my family by trying to do this comedian thing. I have to just man up. I got to man up and I have to go to Phoenix where I have an opportunity and make something of myself. So I do that. Pack up my U-Haul. And it was an interesting day because it was my birthday. It was December 12th, 2012, 12, 12, 12. I will never forget the ride either, because I'm driving down the 10 freeway in my U-Haul full of all my belongings and a haboob. If you guys aren't familiar with what a haboob is, it's a big giant dust storm that we get here in Phoenix. I'd never heard of these things, but I'm on the 10 freeway and I'm in the middle of a dust storm. And I think it's the apocalypse, because I had never experienced one of these things before. I'm bawling my eyes out. I feel like I've just left behind, you know, my dreams of fame and fortune to you know, go and do poor real estate, poor Jamil, right? And now I'm in this apocalyptic dust storm that I'm probably going to die in.
But you made it through. The kid is back, Gino.
He came clean on the other side. What makes a successful wholesaler? What characteristics do you see a lot of your students have that saying, hey, I love wholesaling, I'm going to crush this space?
I think the number one skill that a successful wholesaler has is understanding value, right? That's the bottom line of it. If you can know how much something is worth in current condition, and if you can find its potential, the highest and best use, because as wholesalers, I'm not taking somebody's equity. I'm trying to offer 100% of as is value. Where I get my profit margins from is from the potential gain that could happen from a project or a repositioning or a value add situation. So my profit margin comes from the potential that's there, not what exists already. Mm-hmm. So, and I understand how to package that, because that's what I had done. And so I realized that if you can just understand value and see what the play is, like, what could somebody do with this, with the raw materials of this house or of this building, where can they take it? And you'll be successful. Like, for instance, I did a deal with a real estate agent here in Phoenix, Monique Walker. She's like top 5% agents, incredible woman. But I do a deal with her. She had this house listed on the MLS for 6 months. And it was this two bedroom, two bathroom, 6,000 square foot mansion in Arcadia, Arizona. It was a complete gong show of a house. This guy had this super custom, like, monstrosity of a property that nobody wanted to buy, because who builds a two bedroom, two bathroom, 6,000 square foot house? Who, right? Like, yes. You don't do that, right?
Like, people,
you know, 6,000 square feet, you're going to have five baths in it or five beds in it, not two, right? So this guy just had a house that was completely unfunctional and nobody wanted to buy it. But it was on an acre of land and it was zoned R5, meaning that you could, for every acre of land, you could subdivide into five lots.
Five units, yeah.
And so I didn't look at the mansion. I looked at the acre the mansion was sitting on. And so how I packaged that was land value. And I put it under contract. He had put it on the MLS and they were sitting at 900K. But I was seeing comps of acres selling at like 1.1, 1.2, even upwards of like up to 1.3. So I thought, there's a deal here. So I contracted and I get a hold of the people who had bought those acres at 1.2, 1.3. And a gentleman by the name of Mike Zerbib picked up the phone and I pitched him the acre and the opportunity to develop. And he's like, yeah, I love it. I'll take it. I make it $100,000. And I solved the problem for the homeowner and I helped the agent who was completely desperate because her listing was about to expire. So everybody won. Right? I make $100,000. The homeowner gets his money. The agent gets paid. The developer gets land. It's win, win, win. And that's just because I was able to see the highest and best use. I wasn't focused on the two bedroom, two bathroom, 6,000 square foot monstrosity. I was focused on the acre and what the potential of that acre was.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Jamil, you've got Keegley and you've built it out really, really big, the franchise model. When did you notice or understand that, wow, I'm actually building a business? Because I think, I don't want to speculate, but I think a lot of wholesalers get into it just for transactions. They like it because you get quick money, but you got to keep doing it. And you're not really building anything. You're not building anything with equity. It's a great lifestyle, but it's up and down. And Jake and I like to say transactions pay the bills. Equity is what really makes you rich. When was that moment when you said to yourself, wow, I got something really good here. How can I build this into a business?
Well, you know, I was the hustler. I was the transactor. And I can't take credit for having the idea to franchise. It's actually, that was my two business partners, Josiah Grimes and Hunter Runyon. They both younger than I, both very intelligent systems people. And, you know, Josiah comes with the idea to say, look, we're doing really well. Our model is fantastic. Nobody is doing the volume that we're doing here. But the problem, Jamil, is that it's all you. It's all just, you know, the hustle of what we got here. We don't have a business that we can sell. Mm-hmm. And I agreed. I thought, yeah, you're right. We don't, you know, but how is like Open Door doing this? Like how are these other iBuyer style companies, you know, getting investment dollars and positioning themselves as investable businesses. And meanwhile, we're over here actually making money, not losing money like Open Door, but we don't have an opportunity to, or nobody wants to look at us as a potential viable business. Well, you know, he understood that and said, well, there's only two ways that we can really take this to the moon. It's to either go public or franchise. And I'm like, what do you mean by franchise? Like, well, we can take our model and we can systemize it. And if we can prove that we can duplicate it, we can franchise it. Well, let's try that. So we go through that process and we duplicate it. We open up another market and we just duplicate exactly what we did in Arizona and it worked. And then we did it again and it worked. So now we're onto something. So we contract with an attorney who helps us with the filings and all of the documentation. The FDD is a tremendously arduous process in creating that, but we get it done. And you know, now we're in over 100 markets and growing. The franchises are healthy. We make great money in our royalties. It's a happy situation for us. And you know, now I look at it, right? And I think, you know, how many rentals would I have to own to have the income that I'm getting from the business? And it's, I don't even know if I'd be able to accumulate that many in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. Because we'll do over $1 million in assignments every month in just my Arizona corporate store. That's not including my royalties. It's not including other corporate stores. It's pretty fantastic.
Wow. How has wholesaling changed since you've been doing it? I mean, like you started out back in the early 2000s, then you know, you lost everything in 2007, go to become a comedian. Then you move back to LA. Then you flip, you got the house. What have you seen change in the market in the last 15, 20 years?
Well, I think wholesaling had, when I got into it in the United States here, because I'd been doing it in Canada, but we didn't call it wholesaling. There really wasn't even a name for it. I was flipping, you know, I would have called what I was doing flipping, but not wholesaling. I didn't even know the term until I came to America. Mm-hmm. But how it changed, at least for me, because nobody was doing what I was doing in Canada at the time. I was like a lone wolf and everybody thought I was a genius, right? But that was just me kind of bootstrapping that. Here, it was a viable thing. And then I learned that there were these people called gurus that had been teaching this for decades, and Carlton Sheets was the first. And now there's all these people on the internet. And you know, I was like, wow, this is crazy. But I think how it's changed is wholesaling and wholesalers have had a really bad reputation, right? It's not like people are like, yeah, I love my local wholesaler, right?
They do.
You do.
I do. No, so we have a group that we specifically buy from, and we buy from a few other ones. And I want to comment on this because I've been thinking about it for the last few minutes. Don't be a bitch. If you're buying from a wholesaler and they're presenting you a deal that works well for you, don't have this limited mindset that, oh my God, they're getting a piece and that's a problem. If the deal is good for you, then take it and be happy they brought you an opportunity. Because I think that's the problem that a lot of people have is they're like, oh, this guy's making money on me. No, dude, you didn't get the deal. He did. Stop being a bitch. Take the deal if it works for you and thank him. I think that's the issue that we see with this. And we happily, you know, buy from, we have internal wholesalers that look for deals for us. We have other wholesalers that bring us deals. We buy from brokers. If someone we know comes down and knocks on our door, we do not discriminate a good deal. And I think that's the thing that people got to realize. If someone's bringing you a deal, take it and say thank you. Don't be a bitch about it. I just wanted to say that because I think that's a thing that's out there for sure. Yeah,
I agree. I wholeheartedly agree with what you're saying. And I think that if everybody had that abundant mindset, that it would be a much better situation and people would not have, you know, the issues that they have. But well, I will not gloss over.
And if you're a realtor, don't get offended. Like realtors are like, oh my God, they're taking business from me. I got to shut them down. It's like, guys, open up the market. Let's have freedom reign here, okay? Let people perform and let them make money. It's ridiculous to me. But anyways.
It is.
I'm off my soapbox.
Look, when done correctly, Jake, I 1,000% agree. But there's no doubt that there have been some interesting actors in the space up to now. That there's just no doubt, right? There has been shady tactics. There's been people doing, you know, things that were not good.
It says every industry alive.
Exactly.
From contractors to doctors to whatever label you want to put on it. So anyways.
Yep. I think how it's changed in the last 10 years since I've been involved with it here, and at least in the United States, that I think that the ethics of it have really elevated. I think that the people that are involved have become more transparent. And I feel that it's become more acceptable because, look, every business has a wholesale step-up model, right? When I look at McDonald's, for instance, right? There's no farm that grows Big Macs. That's not how it works, right? There's cows. How much is the patty worth in the cow? Eight cents? I paid $8 for my last Big Mac. So is that predatory?
Man.
No, because somebody had to butcher the cow, and then they had to process the meat, then they had to transport it, then they had to reprocess it again, and then they had to cook it. You know, all these things had to happen before I got my tasty Big Mac.
Jake,
so like all the people,
my Chick-fil-A is up to like $10 for a meal right now.
Yeah, but he's in California, Jake. So California price is a little bit higher than Tennessee prices. Okay, I'm just saying, bro. You know what I mean?
But it's a fact, right? Every business model has a wholesale step-up process, and just the same as homes. And if you're looking at these neighborhoods that have these dilapidated houses where there's drug use and all kinds of craziness going on in there, I believe that what we do actually improves neighborhoods. I think that what we do helps the industry and the further rehabbers that are out there that don't have the time to do or go and find the projects. That's the job of the wholesaler. And if we do a good job
of
it, we're
loved. Real
estate's
a team sport, right? So you need people to bring you deals. If you're going to be the one renovating it, you can't probably be the guy that's finding all the deals for yourself. So all of these little niches are team sports, and you got to systematize.
Correct.
That's a great point.
Jamil, before we go to the short answers, last question from the long answer perspective. What mistakes do you see wholesalers making out there right now that we can say, hey, time out, you really shouldn't be doing that?
Well, there's a couple of things, right? I think first, we really have to pay attention to what equitable interest is, right? And I think that's the tool, that's the instrument that we as wholesalers work on, right? By having contractual rights to a house, I have equitable interest in this property. Now I can sell my equitable interest, and that's what has value. I think where wholesalers make mistakes is when they are marketing properties they don't have contractual rights to. I don't think that that's okay. Right. I think that when you've got all these people, if I send a deal out within a half an hour, that deal has now been resent out by 15 other organizations with different prices all over them. And it just gets wacky. Right. So that part to me is I think that needs to get cleaned up. Right. I think that if you do want to co-wholesale in JV, just get permission, get written permission. That's it. Mm-hmm. So I think that needs to kind of get cleaned up. Secondly, I'm not opposed to licensing. I'm not. I think that it, look, how long does it take to get a real estate license? 2 weeks. Everybody in my organization holds a real estate license.
Mm-hmm.
They do, because I did it the right way.
I
knew
man.
That.
I think it's the mafia, man.
Say it again.
I said, I think it's the mafia.
Well,
I don't know.
Look, if it's the mafia, then then put me in, tell me who my godfather is so I can go make money.
It's your broker. I mean, that's it. That's what I'm saying.
I'll kiss the ring. Give me my check.
I guess that's not, you know, that's not how I wish things were set up, but it is what it is, right? So you got to play the game. So, all right, guys, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor.
A question, Gino, and I get a lot is, what's a great value add?
You've just closed a deal and you're looking for a way to maximize the attractiveness of your complex to potential renters.
At Rand Property Management, we start at the bottom. Literally, we start with the flooring.
And that means we start with a call to Christian Chapman and his team at David's Abbey Carpet and Flooring. No one wants to deal with the expense and hassle of putting in new floors, and that is exactly why we turn to David's Abbey.
David's Abbey Carpet and Flooring provides a quality, long-lasting product at a great price. The wear layer and waterproofing that comes standard with all David Abbey products will ensure you are on solid ground for years to come.
My favorite part of working with Christian and his team is convenience. David's Abbey will direct ship their product anywhere in the U.S. That's white glove service, folks.
And your installation team will love how easy it is to install. The next time that you're looking for a great value add, give our friends at David's Abbey Carpet and Flooring a call and speak with Christian.
Or click the link in the show notes to visit their website today.
All right, we're back. Gino's talking about singing The Godfather. We got this one over here, Kissing the Ring. We're getting
I love you, piano and escudo sentira. Sorry, Jake.
Break it down, baby. I love it. So we were getting into the franchise model a little bit and talking about scaling. What is the best tip you could give for the listeners for scaling a business? Because that's where so many people fall short.
That's a really great question. Well, first, I think that if you have a desire to build a business that's scalable, start with the end in mind. I think what ends up happening is that people get into a company or they get into a business, starts doing well. And then they think, hey, what I'm doing right now is exactly what I do in order to, I just have to do this more. But it breaks. Everything breaks at scale if you do it the exact same way. Mm-hmm. So the way that we looked at it was, okay, we started, you know, we knew when we were starting Keeg Lee that our goal was to build a national company. We didn't know we were going to franchise, but we wanted to go national. My desire was to do a deal in every state. That was the initial ambition that I had. I want to transact in every state. I want to be everywhere, right? And so with that mind and with that ambition, that's how we began and operated. And so even just by having my staff licensed right out the gate, you know, I knew here in Arizona that if I was going to employ people to have conversations and negotiate contracts, that the ADRE, that's Arizona Department of Real Estate, was going to check to see if my people were licensed. So rather than get shut down, rather than get a cease and desist and have a blemish on my company, we just came out the gate licensed. Right. And so I would say that if you are wanting to build a scalable business, start with the end in mind. See what it looks like. You know, what does it look like for you? What envision what that looks like. For me, it's actually one day selling my company to a private equity company, to a private equity firm. I visualized that. I saw that. And so now I got to build it backwards.
Mm-hmm. Love that.
Yeah. Got it. So when I hear your story today, I wrote down, don't confuse effort with results. I think so many people go through the motions or they do the actions, but they don't actually see it through to getting the results. So that's what I'm seeing. But what would you say your best habit for success is?
Oh man, I am so routine. Like I am a predictable MF-er.
Boring AF.
And say it again.
I said you're boring as fuck.
I am.
Oh, it's good. I am too, even, dude.
even to the food I eat, like I'll eat the same thing.
I do too. Yeah.
Every day, if I had, you know, and I don't even care. I like it. I like consistency, right? I wear the same clothes. I eat the same food. I wake up at the same time. I do the exact same thing every single day, and to me, if I'm pushed out of that routine, that's when I break. So I love to be routine. I love to be consistent. When I can just get up and robotically have my day the way that it is, then I know that I'm on my path. I know I'm doing the right thing. I think that's my superpower.
Consistent. But if something is not working, you can make a slight tweak to the machine, which is you and your system, and improve upon it.
Yes.
And if you're seeing it work, you keep doing the same thing until it's not working the way it needs to, and then you make tweaks to the machine. I mean, that's I think how many of us look down upon ourselves, and I would say track our success, and that's how we can look back objectively and say this is not working, and I'm going to switch this in my routine to make it work. So I completely agree with that. Any book recommendations, anything that you've read in the last year or so that will add value to the folks listening?
Well, there's my favorite book that I've read, and it's not even a business book, but I'm an avid meditator. I really believe in calming and going within to try to understand who and what you are.
They say it makes sex better.
You're supposed to be
relaxed.
I've never meditated during sex.
Gino's so uncomfortable right now. It's beforehand, man. You got to stop, baby. Visualize it. All right, come on, guys. You guys are getting
a little uncomfortable, bro. Come on.
Hold on a second. I'm just gonna follow my breath here for a second, babe. I'll be right back.
Let's get into rhythm as a dancer now. Come on.
That's great. No, my favorite book is The Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda, and an incredible spiritual book of and story of a man, a great man who goes on a journey towards enlightenment. And it's beautiful. It's just a beautiful story. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. And even if it's not true, it shows the power of the human spirit, and how if we really want to, we can connect to something greater than ourselves and to everyone on this planet. And if you think about it, if you really think about it, right? If we are connected to everybody, then anything that you could possibly want could actually happen. You could really create the life that you wanted by going inside and then taking necessary steps towards it and creating your life, creating your destiny, creating your luck. And I think I've lived that, you know, and maybe it's just because I've been relentless and I've tried and I just haven't given up.
No, but you know, that's
because I've been beaten up and I've failed.
Stop right there for a second. Hold it right there. Gino and I were literally talking about this yesterday. I want to drive this point home. We were joking about Colonel Sanders and Ray Kroc. You brought up McDonald's. Both those guys were in their probably mid to late 50s before they hit it. And the only thing that separates them from, if you're listening right now and you're an engineer or you're a lawyer, you're a doctor, you're a professional, and you're not getting to where you want to be, it's because you quit. You're in a W-2 job, and let's be honest with ourselves, folks. The people that make the real bank, the people that are really wealthy in this country, they own businesses and they invest in real estate. We can keep it simple right there. If you're working a W-2 and you quit on your dreams, that's on you and nobody else. But it's the effort to get out there and start and create something that's going to separate you at the end of the day.
Let me expand upon that for a second, though. It's not just creating wealth. To have a successful life, you need to be responsible. And I think some people don't aspire to be wealthy. Some people love their W-2 jobs.
And that's okay.
That's great.
I'm not saying you have to be either.
I don't want people to take your right. what you said, you know, incorrectly.
It's just for me.
It's just that the responsibility factor has to be there, and the long-termism has to be there. You can create wealth with a W-2 job. It's going to take longer. It's a lot less efficient, a lot less tax. You don't have really control of your time. You have less autonomy, but you can do it. But the difference between someone who's successful in their W-2 and who's not is the responsibility. You show up early. You really perform for your boss. You really stay later. You just try to be a team player, try to do as much as possible. You're actually craving responsibility, and that's the one, I think, example that you can be as an entrepreneur or as a W-2 person. If you have that responsibility and you love what you're doing and you show up every day, you will be successful long term.
Totally agree.
And I think, Jim, I think it was such a great point, because I do think that's the big separator, right? There's people a lot smarter than me that I make a shit ton more money than because I didn't quit on myself. And that's, I think, the separator there. So what's the best way for folks to get a hold of you if they want to take a step closer to you and your organization? How do folks go about doing that?
You can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/JamilDamji. That's JamilDamji. Also on IG at JDamji. And if you watch TV, I don't, but if you watch TV, you can see me on Saturdays at 10 a.m. on A&E, and we flip houses. It's cool.
Yeah.
Dude, triple-digit flip, baby. It's a good show.
That's the same time Garfield is, man.
Listen, you watch your Garfield, DVR triple-digit flip, and then watch us. I'm not going
to take
you away
from the
cat. He doesn't
know who he's talking to, Gino. Like, he thinks I know how to DVR, right? I don't even have one of those fucking things.
Hey, you did help with the tech today, bro. You're a big techie. This is the day before the show came on, so big kudos to you.
All right, so now this is the special part of the show where Gino serenades you. So I will take a step back and say, G Daddy, take it away.
Well, I want to share Jamil's story because it's really, I didn't know too much about it, but it's fascinating to see somebody who was born in Canada to immigrant parents. You know, one was shoveling gravel and the other was working data entry. And their dream for their son was, I want you to be a doctor. And the son, as most immigrant children do, is like, okay, I'll respect those wishes. I'll go to school. I got a 4.0. When it's time to take the medical boards, I got my cousin behind me. He's flipping out. He's cheating on my sheet. He gets into it. I don't. I feel like a total loser. And what do I end up doing? I end up quitting, leaving that, and going to start creating websites. And I really wasn't good at that business because my cash flow was negative. I mean, it doesn't cash flow. You let the grass grow. That grass was growing, baby. We didn't even know about it, but it took a year. But then the great thing about it was he didn't quit. He saw what his partners were doing. They're making money in real estate. And there's so many different ways to make money in real estate. That's the great thing. That equitable interest will always stick with me. I like that slogan. You need to have equitable interest. He saw the first flip. He made $47,000. It took him all the way to the letter S to get to that lawyer, but he didn't quit. Just like the rest of his life.
Yeah. Sneedly? Yeah, there you go.
David Steed.
David Steed. And that's the important thing, Jake. That's, I guess, the important thing about his life is getting on the calls, constantly taking no's, constantly taking rejections. I think the comedy was part of it. I'm sure he went up on stage, worked at that, a lot of booze, a lot of heckling, a lot of hard work. But then I think that real estate was just kept pulling him back and pulling him back. And he became really good at wholesaling. And now, you know, with over 100 franchises, with his Astro flipping and his education side, he's really made a big mark on wholesaling. And it's been an honor and a privilege to have him on the show today.
Fantastic. Jamil, wow. Absolute pleasure. Really, really appreciate your time today. And guys, as always, we believe in buying deals for the long term. Think in decades. I'm Jake. He's the G Daddy, and we make it happen. We'll see you next time.